The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm David Remnick. My guest today is one of the most important women in television and indeed all the known fantasy world. Her resume is impressive, to say the least, with credentials including the Queen of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Queen of Marine, Lady Regent of the Seven Kingdoms, Breaker of Chains, and Mother of Dragons. I'm talking, of course, about Daenerys on HBO's Game of Thrones, played by Emilia Clarke.
I am Daenerys Stormborn, of House Targaryen, of the blood of old Valyria. I am the dragon's daughter, and I swear to you that those who would harm you will die screaming.
You will not hear me scream.
She survived seven seasons of Game of Thrones, and we're about to find out quite soon if she survives the eighth and final season. And if I said it's eagerly anticipated, that would be the understatement of the television decade. I spoke with Emilia Clarke just last week. Emilia, I have to tell you, I kind of grew up as a journalist at the Washington Post, and of course, all I ever wanted to do was break a story bigger than Watergate. So do me a big solid and tell me the entire ending plot for Game of Thrones.
Well, I mean, it's all I want to do. Genuinely, all I want to do is just tell people. It's like this thing when you're stood on top of a skyscraper and you're like, I'm just going to throw myself off. I'm going to throw myself off this building. And I feel the same about Game of Thrones. I feel like one day it's just going to come out because I can't keep it in anymore.
What happens if you give up the plot? Do the cops come and get you?
I think so. I genuinely think that's what will happen. I think that the HBO or Nightwalker is just going to turn up on my door and go, well, now it's time.
Let me try a different tact then.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
So in the first season, Daenerys goes from abused daughter of the ousted king into an unwanted marriage. Then she falls in love with her husband. He gets killed. She throws herself into his funeral pyre. She emerges from the fire reborn with three baby dragons. It's pretty incredible.
That's season one.
What was the most memorable part of that season?
Of that season, almost every minute of that season was memorable. I will never again, and I doubt anyone who's a part of it, will feel the camaraderie and the just the joy of, it never felt polished. It never felt like anyone really knew exactly what was going on. Everyone was just running on adrenaline and trying to figure it out. And we knew we had something exciting, but we didn't really know what it was. And we're all new. I mean, I was a part of, I think there was like six or seven of us who were all the same age, all with zero experience, all British, all kind of just going, oh, this is pretty cool. But there's a number of moments that really stand out for me in that season. But I mean, walking into the fire, actually, was the, because I kind of set myself alight a little bit.
You did.
I was so earnestly trying to do everything that anyone would ever want me to do, because I just didn't want to mess up.
Wait, did you get burned?
Well, I mean, so I walked into the fire and I just never forget everyone being like, stop, because we'd built a real fire. And there were these flame bars that I could walk through to sort of simulate it looking like me walking into this fire completely. But in the middle was the real fire. So I just kept walking because I thought someone would tell me.
You should not do that.
And I just never forget, there's this metal ring on my costume, and it just started to get burning hot. And then my costume was quite, you know, I'm pretty sure we sprayed it, but it was quite flimsy. And I just remember a little tiny bit of it just went and caught, and I was like, oh, I need to put that out. Oh, I'm in the middle of a fire. But all the crew and everyone involved was screaming for me to get out. And I don't know. I was just sort of in the moment.
So, Amelia, the filming of this ends after the first season. You go home to London.
Yes.
You visit with your parents in Oxfordshire. You describe this in your NewYorker.com article. And then on a fine February day, you do what people do. You go to the gym. You're going to work out with your trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there in a locker room and you're overcome. What happens?
Yeah, well, I really dragged myself to the gym that day. I'm sure anyone who's dragging themselves to the gym right now will empathize. But it was a kind of exhaustion that was sort of, it was incredibly exhausting to even put on my shoes. And then I'm doing the plank and I suddenly get this unbelievable pain. That felt very much like an elastic band around my brain.
Mm.
Excruciating. And whilst, you know, you're used to things hurting in the gym, I was pretty aware quite early on that that wasn't normal. So the rest is kind of blurry as to how I managed to get to the loo, but I sort of crawled my way there and then was just violently ill. And I knew in that moment, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that headache like that and throwing up means brain damage. So I just kind of went into fighter mode, you know, DEFCON 5. It was, I was trying to move every part of my body that I could and trying to kind of at every point ask myself questions of where are you? What's your name? What are your parents' names? You know, what date is it? Think of a line from the TV show you've just finished filming.
Mm.
Everything I could to stay present in the moment that was this so much pain.
And you're completely alone in the bathroom. Nobody can hear you?
Well, I mean, I don't know what kind of noises I must have been making, but there's a woman who was in the stall next to me, and I've never seen her face. I don't know who she was at all, but she pulled me out of the bathroom and on into the recovery position and was trying to get help. An ambulance turns up and someone's got my phone and I think they're calling my mum. And then I get in the ambulance and I arrive at this hospital in London after quite a bumpy journey, and they sort of don't quite know what to do because it's so hard to diagnose this.
This being what?
This being a brain hemorrhage.
Yeah.
So I had bleeding on the brain.
So the surgery you had was not a craniotomy. They did not open up your skull. They go in through a femoral artery.
Yes.
And a kind of wire goes up and around and up miraculously to your brain, and it seals things off and out you come. And you had this. It took some hours. And then you wake up. Mm-hmm. What did the doctors tell you about your prognosis? What could you expect?
I was so out of it before they put me under, before they gave me the surgery. So I had zero information as to what I was expected to feel or how I was, and that continued for at least the first week at least of just not really knowing, not really being present.
You write that there's a kind of 2-week barrier that you got to get past, and obviously you got past it, but after that you experienced a real difficulty speaking or recalling your name. What describe that, because that must have been scary as hell.
Oh my God, yeah. So they wake you up every 2 hours in a brain ward, ask you questions. Where are you? What's the date? What's the Prime Minister? What's your name? They woke me up at, you know, 2 a.m. or whatever it was. And as, you know, I was getting very like, hey, listen, you don't need to keep waking me up every 2 hours. Okay, I know how to say my name. And I couldn't.
In fairness, you have a long name.
Yes, yes. Amelia Isabel Euphemia Rose Clark. My brain was screaming it. It was screaming the answer, but I knew that I wasn't forming the words. I couldn't make sense. And it was the scariest thing I've ever experienced in my life. I was, especially as someone who, as you're quickly realizing, talks a lot. Every part of me is you know, relating to another human being. And I, in that moment, I felt if I can't communicate, I don't know how to do that.
In the New Yorker piece, you describe thinking that you are not going to make it and maybe that you don't want to.
Yeah, it wasn't so much that I didn't think I was going to make it. It was that I wasn't prepared to make it. It was in that moment I asked them to just let me die, literally. It was one thing being, you know, having the bleed and getting over it and trying to figure out what my life would be. But having that as a thing that I would have to live with for the rest of my life, in that moment I just wasn't ready to carry on.
Why did you decide to keep this catastrophe secret?
Well, in the beginning, it was season one. It was very much no one knows who the hell I am. I don't want to cause any trouble. I don't want anyone to think I'm not capable of doing the job that they've given me, which is my first big job. And
you were scared they were going to take it away from you?
Yeah, I think I was scared they were going to take it away from me. I think I was also, I just didn't want to be a bother.
Okay, that's the most English thing I've ever heard. You didn't want to be a bother after brain surgery.
Yeah, more than anything, I was a young girl who was given a huge opportunity, and I did not for any reason want to give anyone a reason to think I was anything other than beyond capable of fulfilling my duties that they'd given me. And I didn't even know what the show was at that point. All I knew was that I had a job.
Well, your first duty was to deal with a publicity tour. The show absolutely blew up.
Yeah.
It became incredibly famous. It would become even more so as the seasons rolled on. How did you deal with that publicity tour while still not quite even remotely back to 100%?
Well, HBO were incredible. It's only in looking back now that I realize how kind and generous they were with me. As I went to the photo shoots with my morphine bottle and straw, it was my first publicity shoot, and they made it just, you know, well, we've got this room and you can just sit down, and actually this photo is just going to be lying down, and what else can we do to kind of make this a little bit easier for you? And those days were just a haze, an absolute haze of god-awful fatigue and fear.
So HBO knew, obviously your family knew, but it's more or less a secret. You go back to film season two. And you say in your essay that it was your worst season of the eight. Why is that?
Yeah, well, it was such a... Season one was such a hard act to follow for Daenerys because, like I said, everything happened then. And then season two, even in the books, she's sort of in a holding pattern. And at the same time, I was every day thinking I was going to die. And I didn't want to do that on set.
Well, there was a big shadow hanging over you. You knew now that not only were you recovering from the aneurysm that you had had surgery on, but you had another one, a small one, on the other side of your brain.
Yes. So that was the thing that I missed out. But they told me quite early on, but it was so, we were dealing so much with the first one that we sort of just were like, oh, yeah, so there's another one on the other side. And it's only when you leave hospital that then that other one on the other side becomes your every thought, that maybe that's just going to rupture because what would stop it from rupturing if the other one already has? But the second one was so small that the risk factor of operating was greater than just letting it be. The chances of it rupturing were low. So, but that was definitely my every thought.
So the first surgery was in 2011. In 2013,
yeah,
you go in for another scan. You're in New York at this point. And they say, you know what, let's get rid of this thing now. It's gotten bigger. Easy peasy, we'll go in, be no problem.
Yeah. They were like, we'll make it so comfortable for you. Come on in. It'll be 2 hours in surgery. We'll keep you overnight just to keep an eye on you. Everything's gonna be hunky dory.
And again they go in through the femoral artery, not through the head, and you wake up from the procedure and you are told.
Yeah, so they woke me up because they legally have to. I was actually in an operating room, I remember. And according to my parents, I was just screaming. Just wouldn't stop screaming.
From pain?
From pain, because they woke me up to say that the coils had got stuck, which is a risk factor when you're doing these, you know, no surgery is 100%. So I had a much bigger bleed. And so they had to wake me up to say, listen, we have to put you into open brain surgery. We have to cut your head open and save your life. But we have to let you know that we're doing that and we need your verbal consent. So I remember my mum and my dad in the corner of the room and my mum just being like, it's going to be all right. Yeah, you can say yes. You can say yes. It's okay. And obviously they're, you know, reading you your you might die thing. So I go back under and... the story as my mum tells it is, because the first operation was about 8 hours, and then this operation was another 5, I think. So I'm in the second operation is happening, and they come down and they're like, we really don't think she's going to make it. We really, really think she's going to die because the bleed is huge. So then they come down and say to my mum, she's alive, but she's absolutely brain damaged. When blood doesn't get to a part of your brain, it literally in that moment will just stop working. And so they were like, we don't know what part of the brain it is, but that's gone. And then they come down half an hour later and go, woohoo, the blood has found very, very, very quickly found another way to get around this. And so whatever this bit of her brain is that's gone, we've had a real look and we don't really know what abilities it might be. It might be her concentration. It might be her peripheral vision. It might be, as I like to joke, her taste in men. But she's alive and she, you know, the major parts of her brain that could have been damaged have not by some miracle. And then I wake up.
Now, the recovery you describe in the piece is even worse than last time. More pain, more prolonged. And it goes on quite a long time. But do you recognize in yourself any deficits other than joking around about taste in men?
So in the beginning, when I was still at hospital, they asked me to draw a clock and I couldn't. I thought I was drawing it perfectly, but I had drawn it the wrong way around. And I just, the overriding thing that happened immediately after this one that was different to the first one, I couldn't look anyone in the eye, including my parents.
Why is that?
I think blind fear, because it felt like a bit of me was just gone forever. And I didn't know who would be looking back. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
did you sense in the eyes of others when you were looking at them, or hard as it was, that they were terrified for you or were? Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I remember my dad saying to my mum later, he was like, there was a minute there I thought she was bipolar. I was so extreme in my emotions at that time. Those first 3 weeks were just pure turmoil, just scared. And I think I kind of exited the building, as it were, just from complete fear of just not knowing who I was, what was going on. The fact that I couldn't trust my mind. I think there's an innate fear in yourself that you have, that if that doesn't work and if that could go wrong again, then what am I? How can I operate? How can I in any way exist in this world if I can't trust that my brain is everything I think it is?
Probably an impossible question to answer, but how do you feel that you're a different person or different in any way now than you might have been having not gone through this double crisis?
It's funny, I didn't finish thinking, woohoo, carpe diem, let's jump off the cliff and do all the, let's do the bucket list now.
Right.
I had the exact opposite. I thought I was going to die every day. So I just feel more aware of the smorgasbord of things that life has to offer you. Be it, you know, dragon riding fame, or be it life-threatening brain damage. I feel that it's taken me, you know, this amount of time to fully appreciate all that lies in between those two things.
Amelia Clark, thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks.
You can read Amelia Clark's essay at newyorker.com. The last season of Game of Thrones premieres in April, and if that's too long to wait for high drama, in a moment we'll check in on the state of play in Brexit, with Ed Caesar reporting from Manchester. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. obvious, but with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. From the moment that British citizens voted in a referendum to leave the European Union, confusion and disorganization has absolutely consumed the UK. And 3 years later, nothing much has changed. Confusion and disorganization may yet carry Britain over the cliff, so to speak, to a no-deal Brexit with devastating economic consequences. But if we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, we're learning a little bit more about what brought Great Britain to the edge of the cliff in the first place. Much like our 2016 election, the pro-Brexit vote employed divisive social media campaigns, mysterious sources of financing, Cambridge Analytica, and meetings with Russians. At the center of it is a man named Aaron Banks, an insurance magnate. Reporter Ed Caesar has been digging into Banks' outsized role in the referendum, and Ed joins me now from Manchester. Ed, I think when many Americans think about Brexit, when they can focus on it at all, they think of figures like Boris Johnson or Nigel Farage, but they don't think about the person that you've written about at such great length in The New Yorker, a person named Aaron Banks. Who is that?
Aaron Banks is perhaps the single biggest political donor in UK history. And he helped to fund both Nigel Farage, but also a rambunctious outlier organization called Leave.eu. And Aaron Banks gave about $13 million in all to anti-EU causes. And there have been a few questions about where his money comes from, because there are big disputes about how rich he actually is. He says £250 million. Financial journalists who have seen publicly available information for him think it's about 10% of that figure.
So the implication is that he's a conduit somehow for the money for a third party.
That has been an implication, and that's what the National Crime Agency of the United Kingdom, which is our version of the FBI, is now looking into in an investigation.
What's the evidence that he might have done something wrong?
Well, he has given various accounts of his donations and his portfolio of business interests. And the Electoral Commission, who referred him to the National Crime Agency, said the story of his donations had changed dramatically over time. There is also the question of this very opaque, sprawling business empire that he has, where so much of it is in offshore locations, which are secrecy jurisdictions, the Isle of Man, Bermuda, Gibraltar. And the very fact of having businesses there leads to many more questions about why you would headquarter now, in those places.
Among the many reasons that your story about Aaron Banks and Brexit has a resonance with the American situation and the situation with the investigation into the Trump administration is, we could summarize it by saying, A, Cambridge Analytica, and B, Russia.
Yes.
To what degree does Cambridge Analytica, is it mixed up with Aaron Banks and Leave.eu?
Well, Cambridge Analytica and Leave.eu had a relationship of some kind, and you know, Banks has not been entirely straightforward about that. However, I don't think that's the biggest part of the story here. But to me, the much bigger angle in this is the Russia angle, because Banks has a Russian wife, because she has a somewhat intriguing past.
What is her past? Why is it intriguing?
Well, her past is she was deported from Dubai before she married her first husband, who was a much older man in Portsmouth. That lasted a matter of months and attracted the attention of special branch officers of the police who are interested in national security. And she married Aaron Banks a couple of years after that. She has a very interesting history in that her ex-husband told me that she had had an affair with a member of parliament called Mike Hancock, who also had an affair sometime later with another young Russian woman called Ekaterina Sutuleveta, who MI5 thought had been spying for the Russian Foreign Intelligence Services. And eventually a panel cleared her of espionage on the balance of probabilities. But still, large questions remain over why these two young women had an affair with a member of parliament who at one time chaired the all-party group on Russia. That has raised a few eyebrows.
Now, let's dig into what Russia's motivation would be to get involved in Brexit at all. Why would Vladimir Putin care about Brexit one way or the other?
Well, he says he doesn't care about it, but all the evidence points the other direction. So he is interested in weakening the European bloc. Brexit is a big part of that weakening. He is interested in chaos, in people that he perceives to be somewhat his geopolitical enemies. And in 2016, certainly, Britain was at odds with Russia over things like the invasion of Crimea and sanctions. There is also this question of Russia feels that the West has been meddling in Russian affairs, at least for 10 years, and actively pursuing, destabilizing measures against Russia. And they have pushed back in this asymmetric way by supporting far-right and populist groups within Europe. Now, the question is, what did they do about it? There seems to be no doubt in the minds of people who watch Russia closely that they were certainly interested in the destabilizing nightmare of Brexit as we're now witnessing it.
Now, you write about an incredibly long, boozy lunch held between the Russian ambassador in London and Aaron Banks. Now, how common is it for a Russian ambassador to have a six-hour boozy lunch with a businessman of Aaron Banks' scale?
Well, I wouldn't speak to his, preferences for dining partners, but it seems to be unusual, at the very least, that this figure who was, until, shortly before the referendum, quite a minor figure in British public life, is suddenly treated to this, great and lavish lunch. And not only that they have this lunch where they finish up drinking vodka supposedly made for Joseph Stalin, but that, a few days later, there's another meeting at which the ambassador's introducing Banks to a Russian businessman who's offering him a part in a multi-billion gold deal in Russia, and that this chain of events leads to various other business deals being dangled in front of Aaron Banks. All of that seems quite unusual. And having spoken to people who worked in the CIA, with a special interest in Russia, they say that it would be, it's almost impossible to believe that there was not some kind of ulterior motive in this courting of Banks.
Well, is there any hard evidence, documentary evidence, that Banks was offered any business opportunities with Russian companies as a quid pro quo?
Well, we don't know about the quid pro quo, but he was offered business opportunities with the Russian state diamond producer, Alrosa. He was offered to be an investor in this consolidation of six Russian gold companies.
Which Banks does not deny.
He does not deny.
So you yourself had a long meeting with Banks and his PR guy, and you've gotten on the phone with him subsequently for any number of conversations. How does Banks answer accusations that he promoted Brexit on behalf of Russia or used Russian money to promote Brexit?
He says it's nonsense. He actually uses slightly stronger language than that. He says that you shouldn't be judged on business deals that you don't do. And, he gave me a very long and detailed interview, and we went back and forth on all the details of this. The fact is that on its face, a lot of this stuff does look suspicious, and you know, it seems worthy of further investigation. You know, he refutes that anything nefarious was going on.
Now, any number of people in your piece say that we, meaning the British government, should have a Mueller-type investigation directed against Brexit and specifically Arron Banks. Has that taken hold at all, or is that just something that three or four commentators say for the purposes of sounding off?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon because, as you may have noticed, we're having a constitutional crisis, and you know, we're still, you know, we're 8 days away from crashing out of the European Union with no deal. And
yeah, but wait a minute. The United States is having crises all over the place, but we're having investigations at the same time.
That's true. I just, the way it was explained to me, even by people who, you know, members of parliament who really want this, is just there's no appetite. Certainly with Theresa May, there's no appetite. Jeremy Corbyn has no appetite. You know, the most senior figure to have called for this investigation, who called for it again after my piece was published on Monday, is Tom Watson, who's the deputy leader of the Labour Party, who is, you know, he says it, you know, this piece makes a, you know, a cast iron case for a Mueller-style inquiry. Now, whether we're going to get it in 6 months, possibly when all of this is over, who knows?
Now, we're talking on a Thursday afternoon in Britain. What's the current status of Brexit? What's the possibility of no deal? And is there any possibility of a kind of do-over in which there's another referendum, or has that just been ruled out?
Theresa May has ruled it out, which isn't to say that it's not going to happen. I think it's an outside chance. You know, President Macron of France, was just talking to a reporter on the way to an EU summit saying, you know, as it stands, you know, no deal in 8 days is the clear favorite. So I feel quite pessimistic. You know, no deal would be a really poor outcome for the UK, even for people that were really into the Brexit project. I'm not sure many of them wanted food shortages and shortages of medicine and chaos at the borders. You know, that wasn't the thing that was sold to the British people. So I, you know, Arron Banks says no deal was his preferred option because no deal means we leave. It's the clearest rupture that you could have. But to me, it feels like vandalism.
And finally, when this drama ends, if it ever ends, who inherits the earth politically in Britain?
Oh, that is a very good question. Because both sides, Conservative and Labour, the two biggest parties, have been ripped in two by this. I think we could see a much more fragmented political landscape in which coalitions become much more normal. Because the Brexit, you know, disaster, nightmare, has ripped the Conservative Party and the Labour Party in two. I feel like history will judge this period of our politics extremely badly.
Ed Caesar, thanks so much.
So kind. Thanks so much.
Enjoy. Yeah, I guess I can't say enjoy, but survive.
Thank you so much.
Be well. You can find Ed Caesar's piece on Arron Banks and his role in Brexit at newyorker.com. Burkhard Bilger is a staff writer and a man of wide interests: technology, science, nature, sports, food, southern culture, German history, and much more. Burke also happens to be a good musician. He's been singing in choirs since he was young, and he keeps a guitar in his office where he's always noodling on it. He taught his kids to play old-time music and launched the Bilger Family Band. And as his kids grew up, they in turn expanded his musical horizons.
So my son is a bassist, upright bassist and jazz bassist, and was the first one who told me about Roomful of Teeth. And so, I don't know, a few years ago, he played me Partita, the Caroline Shaw piece, and I just thought it was astonishing. I've been listening to choral music my whole life, and I'd never heard anything like this before.
Every year, the members of Roomful of Teeth gather for a few weeks, and they rehearse new pieces and bring in composers who are going to write their repertoire for the following year. The residency is at Mass MoCA, a museum in an old industrial town in Massachusetts. And last time, Burke Bilger tagged along.
Roomful of Teeth is a vocal octet, so four men, four women, who sing contemporary classical music. They sing only newly composed pieces. So we're sitting in a loft space on the second floor of one of the mill buildings in Mass MoCA. It's a huge room with enormous high ceilings, I don't know, 12, 13 feet high. And there's some onlookers, but also kind of a semicircle of composers with a singer in the middle. And this is a process that always happens at Mass MoCA with Roomful of Teeth, where they'll spend a day just having each singer introduce themselves to the composers and giving them a sense of exactly what their abilities are, what they like to do, what they don't like to do, where their voice can go, where it can't go, what their range is.
Yeah. So, like, it would be really easy to have little bits of breaks like that if it were... Because that would be belted, and then I'd be like, that's just, it's just high, like, resonance.
Esli Gomez is the highest soprano in the group. She was the youngest member of the group when she joined.
Yeah, it was my first year out of undergrad when I heard about the premise and took a train from New Haven to New York and did a Skype audition with Brad. And I did a Bulgarian folk song, a jazz song, a Schumann, you know, art song, and a Handel, like, rage aria. And it was like... so relieved that I wasn't auditioning for grad school. So it's like, I don't have to fit in this weird box that doesn't make sense yet. And then heard about this and was like, that sounds like
that's
me.
It.
That sounds
it.
Better.
That's better for grad school.
Yeah.
Maybe you can give us an example of you singing the styles you were talking about running from the beginning.
All the members of the group are trained classical singers, but they incorporate techniques, vocal techniques from all over the world. Over the course of the day, as the singers come in one by one, they'll showcase all kinds of different techniques. Some people are expert tube and throat singers. Some people can do the deep Karkaroff.
Wow, wow, that sort of sound.
Yodeling or belting. So you get a whole range of just astonishing capabilities of the human voice. I mean, I've been singing my whole life, and I'm used to what vocal music sounds like. And suddenly, it's like hearing a saxophone sound like a violin and sound like a kettle drum and sounding like a bassoon. It's like, I didn't know the voice could do that.
It's fun.
Western classical singing has for centuries been divided into essentially two techniques. There's choral singing, which is meant to blend and what we call straight tone without vibrato. And then there's bel canto, which is what we hear in opera, which is a very powerful, athletic vocal technique, which is designed to kind of vault over the sound of an orchestra and fill an entire concert hall. What's excluded from those two techniques is everything else in the world that people have done with the human voice. All these wonderful throat singing techniques and yodeling and belting and ways in which the voice can be rough or gritty or kind of mess with all what we think of as kind of pure classical technique.
The way composers have used choirs over the last 100 years, I started to feel like there was a certain sense of straitjacketedness.
Now, Brad Wells is the founder and artistic director of Roomful of Teeth. He founded this group in 2008 in order to bring in these new techniques. And part of that was inviting singers from all over the world to instruct them in these techniques.
We can reach out and bring somebody from Central Asia and hear them sing and ask them questions and have them teach us for a while about a completely different way of using their voice. You know, where the larynx sits, how much constriction, how much air. All those things are really just basic physiological things, and they manifest in all these different ways around the world. And I thought if composers could get their hands on this and see what's possible, and singers could play with it and stretch the color range of their own voices, then what we understand as choral music might become much more variegated.
So it's really not about we're going to become tube and throat singers or pansori singers or canto tonori singers.
Not at all, no. It's really just a kind of pushing the bounds, pushing the walls of what's beautiful in a way. It's like finding what people consider as beautiful and letting composers play with that and see what emerges.
One of the composers at Mass MoCA this week is Eve Beglarian, a really adventurous New York composer. She's setting a piece by Walt Whitman to music, but in the meantime, she's trying to see what new kinds of sounds she could make with the group. So what's your plan for this afternoon? What are you going to do with the group to get ready for this?
Driving down, I happened to hear Elvis Presley's cover of Blue Moon, and it's so held back. I mean, he's very close mic'd, and from what I can tell, there's different processing on the two double tracks. One of them has a really striking slapback echo.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart.
So I'm thinking we can try setting up our own cover of Elvis's cover, and try having different people paired to do different aspects of the tune. I mean, it may be totally dumb. I don't know. We'll see. So I thought what we could do is set up the accompaniment for now, right? Let's start with
it's late in the afternoon in the loft, and Beglarian is working with the group. She's playing around with the sounds they can make, trying to see what tools might end up working in the piece she's composing.
And I put up the lyrics. Maybe the two of you to start. That's the blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart. Right? So that you can use all the breath you need to do the whispery consonant-y thing.
And me,
Arturia,
can I hear just by yourself what you're doing?
You saw me standing alone.
It's really weird.
Can we try this with everybody? Let's just try that.
Thing that is that's so not my jam. So I'm sorry.
I'm with you entirely. I'm so with you. Okay, let's hold off on that. Let's you two trade the whispery consonant-y thing, and let's just see what happens there.
Right? Should we just track each other?
Beglarian and the room full of teeth singers are kind of feeling their way together through these new sounds, these new techniques. You might say that what comes out of it are compositions that only a room full of teeth can sing because it's designed so specifically for their voices and their techniques. But the truth is that composers have always been pushing the bounds of the human voice. Mozart, when he wrote the Queen of the Night aria, did it for a specific soprano who could go very high and had a very mobile voice. And little by little, other sopranos learn to do the same thing. Brad Wells hopes that the same thing will happen with the Roomful of Teeth compositions in the future. If the songs are good enough and the techniques are appealing enough, then more and more classical singers will learn how to throat sing, will learn how to yodel and belt and do Korean pansori. And Roomful of Teeth songs will start to sound like yesterday's classical music.
Burkhart Bilger, a staff writer at The New Yorker. We heard from members of Roomful of Teeth, as well as composer Eve Baglarian. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for being with us today. We've got one more story this hour. We're going to go shopping, or maybe just browsing, with Patricia Spears Jones. Jones is the winner of the 2017 Jackson Poetry Prize, and recently she published one of her poems in the magazine. She's a native of Arkansas, living for many years in New York, and a little while back, when it was still quite cold out, we asked Patricia Spears Jones to show us one of her favorite places in the city. And so she took us just around the corner from home.
Hello.
How are you?
Okay, I'm now thawing.
All right, come on this side, there's a little heater.
Oh, that's all right. The name of this shop is Calabar Imports. I like neighborhood spaces. And this is a neighborhood space. When I think of Bedford-Stuyvesant, I think of the place where UB Blakes and Lena Horne were raised. So I've been coming to the shop since 2004, I guess, yeah. At every Calabar Import store, there's always a yellow door. And this very small, very bright shop where there are many paintings, jewelry, there's very colorful garments. One of the things I know about the store and all the stores is that the owner, Atem, is also an architect. And so they're all sort of interestingly designed. There is a partition that sort of opens up the space so you can see the front of the space and then the back of the space. But you can also, from the back of the space, you can look out to the window, which looks out to the street. It's like the usefulness of portals. The bracelets I'm wearing, which are all from Africa, and they're all beaded, and they're all pretty, are from Calabar. I think I bought all of the bracelets that I like because they're not here. There are Frida Kahlo mirrors, and this looks like a Haitian mirror, but I'm not sure. Oh, it's from Peru. Oh, so she has these Peruvian mirrors. They're really beautiful. I am a poet because I started writing when I was 12 years old. I'm a poet because I love words and sound. I'm a poet because it is a very complicated and difficult art form. I like to go to places where I know that I may find something of interest that if I have enough coin, I can purchase. But also that there are moments of community, that people come in and they sit and chat and talk about things, where people know that if I come here on a Wednesday, 3 weeks from now, it'll be here. We need those kinds of places that sort of look like the ideas about how we like the world, that we like color and texture and things that are pretty or odd or in some cases utterly beautiful, and that can be found literally around the corner from where you live.
All right, darling.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm going to go across the street and get a cup of coffee.
Okay.
And read some more June Jordan.
That's Patricia Spears Jones in Brooklyn. And you can hear her read her poem, Seraphim, at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time for a visit with a musician who appears behind the scenes on a vast number of contemporary records, including hits by Kendrick Lamar. He's a producer and singer and bassist, and he goes by the name Thundercat. Till then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.